This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peek.
And I'm Scott Greenberg.
Our bodies are no longer just biological. They're digital, tracked, quantified, and constantly translated into data. From fitness wearables to health apps, technology is reshaping how we understand ourselves, often in ways we don't even notice.
Today on Cool Science Radio, we're joined by Vanessa Chang, author of The Body Digital, to explore how data-driven technologies are transforming our relationship with health, identity, and the human body, and what we gain and risk when biology meets algorithms. Vanessa, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me. Delighted to be here today.
So when you say the body is digital now, what does that actually mean in everyday life? Not in theory, but in practice?
That is a great question. And it kind of invites me to start talking about the kind of broad framework of my book. You know, as you mentioned in your opening, so much of our bodies are translated by fitness trackers and all of that. But I think that you can really parse them out in more kind of refined and granular ways, right? Like, and that's what my book does. How we see is kind of mediated by vision machines, cameras, and they look at us as well. How we hear is also mediated by algorithms. Think about your Spotify playlist or even the algorithms in your earbuds that kind of cancel noise. How you move through a city is determined by, say, the directions you use in your Google Maps or the app you call up on your phone to kind of get a taxi around space or the food you order. All of these actions and the ways our bodies extend into the world, how they look, how they see, how they feel, how they express, are multiply kind of mediated and translated by algorithms in ways that are sometimes obvious and in many ways not as well.
Wow. Well, I hope nobody's listening to my Spotify playlist. They'd be very disappointed.
But
once we actually think about what a digital body is, I guess I want to know, well, then how do we live with this from day to day? How do we coexist with it?
I mean, you already are, aren't you? We're on a Zoom platform right now talking to each other. And, you know, I something I wrote in my book about Zoom is that it's really this kind of this mediation of this relationship that's displaced so many other kinds of relationships. You know, I'm looking at you and, you know, I'm just sitting in this room. I have my setting on Zoom to slightly touch up my appearance. So, you know, you're getting like slightly glossier version of me. That's great for me, I suppose, and for you. But, you know, if we met in person, you might be surprised. How tall am I? Do I really look this way? You know, think about autocorrect on your phone. That's another daily form of coexistence, and that intervenes in how you communicate with other people.
Well, as you say in your book, you make this great point that we have coexisted with technology for a very long time in society, in culture, you know, our physiology, and just how we go through the world. But at many times in history, we have had very pervasive technology too. It's just looked different. But I'm curious, when was the first time that we started even calling our bodies machines?
The first time we started calling our bodies machines. Well, I would say that metaphor in science probably would kind of take place during the Renaissance and kind of around the emergence of clockwork technologies. You know, I think these metaphors around how we talk about bodies tend to mirror the science of the day. You know, currently people often talk about minds and brains in kind of computational terms. So when you look at like the emergence of clockwork technologies, cuckoo clocks, automatons around like the 17th century, Descartes and Julien de la Mettrie were philosophers around that time who really started likening, you know, men to machines. The nature of that machine has evolved as our machines have as well. And with that kind of real, I think, profound consequences for how we actually build technologies and how we relate to them and to each other.
Well, it's funny to think of a body in terms of a machine, perhaps. And it got me thinking with all of the incredible technology around us today and what it tells you, whether or not it's measuring your sleep score, or it's pointing out which should be your next book to read, or whatever it is. Still, if you think about it, the human body is the most amazing machine there is, still, even looking at AI. I mean, is that something that we can all agree on, or no? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that even though the metaphors have persisted, I actually don't think the human body is a machine. I think we evolved with our machines. I think we are in constant dialogue and conversation with our machines. They shape us as much as we shape them. You know, it's in thinking about that conversation that we can really prize how amazing our human bodies are.
So Lynn, that was a great question, because so many of us track our steps, sleep, or heart rate without even thinking about it. I mean, I was at dinner the other night and this person was wearing something called an Oura ring. I was unfamiliar with this technology and then absolutely fascinated by it. And I see Lynn actually has her Oura ring on as well. And, you know, sort of touching in the insurance field, for example, I know that certain insurance carriers now will give discounts on life insurance if you provide them with your data, your, whether it's a Fitbit or smartwatch or even the Oura ring. And I'm just curious, are we changing our behaviors based on the technology? What do these numbers change about how we experience our own lives?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I think that's a really great question. These numbers, you know, there's this idea that these numbers are simply tracking us and the lives that we live. But as with all kinds of technologies in their kind of interface with the human body, they end up becoming goals or ways to kind of reshape the way we are in the world. You know, if you're talking about a human insurance context, yeah, great, that's a discount. But when they change, assess that data and they think you're more of a risk, well, perhaps your rates will go up. But if you start to exercise more, or maybe get your 10,000 steps a day, and you start to think about yourself as someone who's trying to reach 10,000 steps a day, I think your habits really change, and they become contoured to meeting certain kinds of metrics. And that can, I think, come at the cost of, you know, being a human walking through the world.
Yeah, and those numbers can actually feel objective, but they don't always tell the whole story. And in your book, The Body Digital, you talk about data as a kind of mirror. What does it reflect accurately, and what does it distort?
Yeah, that is a great question as well. I mean, you know, I think data is useful up to a point. It can capture a certain kind of human activity, but it's also shaping that human activity. So, you know, I give the example in the book of the smart city. I talk specifically about Hudson Yards, which is this huge development in New York City, and was at the time, I think, the most expensive kind of private real estate initiative ever. And the idea was that it would be a lab for human activity. It would track all kinds of human activity, and in so doing, kind of give people insight into how to make better cities. But there's this kind of major problematic assumption there, which is that the environment and the kind of data tracking apparatus doesn't actually define how people use a particular space. So, you know, data may tell you about certain kinds of human activity, but what it's telling you about is the human activity that it's designed to track, and that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, does actually kind of direct people in certain ways. You know, another example is, I talk about is how when I go on a hike, I like to check my steps when I've done a lot of activity. I don't like to check it otherwise. It makes me feel better about myself. And so when I've gone on a hike, I like to have a look. And one time I went on a hike in Yosemite, and it was a long hike. It was a 10-hour hike that day. And at the end of the day, it said I had climbed 87 floors. Do you think about a place like Yosemite in the sense of the built environment? Not really, right? It's not floors. But that's the kind of metric here. It's about thinking about the built environment. And when I look at that, suddenly I'm thinking, oh, great, I climbed 87 floors. But, you know, it's easy for that to cover over and paper over that kind of experience of moving through the natural world, of the inclines I've seen, inclines I've walked and descended, the world around me. And I think that's something that is lost with this kind of datafied form of governance and collection.
It's so interesting you say that about your hike in Yosemite. I do think about my Oura ring, which I do love for tracking sleep. But when it's telling me I'm getting exercise because apparently I've done housework, I just think, like, what is happening here? Like, how is this transforming my thought? Mm-hmm. And if I'm out, you know, actually doing something active, like, how does that really compare to doing housework? And should we even think of it in those terms, to the degree that I have to completely disregard the activity portion of it? So, because it feels too contrived, much like Yosemite turning into 87 floors. I don't know, somehow it messes with our experience of how we go through the natural world. But have we controlled that, or how have we figured out how to surmount that in the past with these technologies?
I think one of the approaches I take in this book is making connections, right? Historical connections and the kind of historical trajectory of these technological encounters of our bodies, specifically body parts, and how that might inform the present. So in thinking about cities, for example, I wrote about a kind of playful practice by this 1960s based activist group called the Situationists, and they used to go on these walks through cities. They considered the city as kind of like a technological construct. And if you think about a city as a technological construct, you know, it's full of roads. Roads are technologies. It's got traffic lights. It's got all of these things that direct movement and direct how people move in specific ways. You know, their idea was that actually the city is kind of like a machine in itself, directing people to work, to labor, and sometimes to play, but that you know, it comes at the cost of human freedom, as we've been talking about. So they used to do this activity called the derive, or drift. It's this idea that, you know, as you walk through space, you try and get rid of these like aimed, oriented approach, and you allow the environment to kind of tell you where to go. And so I think one approach with technology is to untether yourself from those aims. I don't know if you can turn your Oura Ring off. Maybe perhaps you can. It's always kind of part of it.
Yeah, how to isolate out certain things mm-hmm. and turn it off. But
being maybe a little bit playful with it, or taking direction, you know, not taking direction from it, thinking about it in kind of alternative ways. That's one approach. But I do think there are, when it comes to our kind of current moment and the ways in which data is often conscripted into these kind of like corporate infrastructures, mm-hmm. you know, there's a real limit, I think, to what approaches like personal playfulness can do.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Vanessa Chang. She has written a new book called The Body Digital. It's a brief history of humans and machines, from cuckoo clocks to ChatGPT. I'm interested in how you have organized the book. Your chapters, I'm going to run through them really quickly. Hand, voice, ear, eye, foot, body, mind. And these are all our, you know, each sort of part of our body and how it relates to technology over time. There's so much we do now with our hands. You were describing in the introduction how you were sitting in a coffee shop or something, nursing a cappuccino, I think is what you said, which I loved. And your device is there, you were writing, and you do such a great job of using all these words, like swiping, you know, like that was not a word that, or an action that we would have ever known, but you use a lot of different words like that. So hand is very prevalent in how we use technology, but, you know, let's skip to something like foot. I mean, foot pedometer, I guess, and tracking our steps.
Yeah. Yeah, each chapter is really invested in that particular encounter of body part and technology. So in the chapter about feet, I think about this as a kind of really fundamental encounter between our bodies and our world. You know, when you're walking through a forest, often you're on a path, and paths aren't just there; they are the result of people or animals kind of walking through an environment. There's one a kind of path I learned while writing this book, which is the desire path. And a desire path is it's the path that is off the beaten path, like the kind of shortcut. It's the way in which people kind of don't want to take a particular route. They take a shorter route, and eventually it gets kind of worn into the world. And so roads often blossom from these paths, right? And eventually, and often those roads become the kinds of infrastructure that form the world we know. The Grand Trunk Road in India is now like a major highway. And cities kind of bloom in areas across on those paths and on those roads. And so that kind of initial encounter between foot and world then starts to become mediated and transformed by lots of other kinds of technologies. They become, traffic lights, bridges, and then cars. And then you get cities sometimes that are not designed for people. They get designed for cars, and then they become exiled. So the book kind of really in that particular chapter traces how like the evolution of digital technologies either kind of foster new forms of walking, and they might truck them as they do in the smart city, or they might start to exile them as with like car-centric cities. Either way, you know, the cities, I think, are really interesting lab for the human body these days, right? Because they become sites where so much technology is staged in ways we don't even think about. You know, I live in San Francisco, and we have Waymos everywhere. Do you have that in taxi? No? So Waymos are robot taxis, and they are actually everywhere in San Francisco. And they're expressions of AI in the environment. There's nobody driving them. I see one, I'm not even joking, every 5 minutes. I have to be mindful of how I move through the environment when I see them. Although I will say they often are better than the human drivers around us. And, you know, they are an added layer of kind of like algorithmic technologies that are embodied in the environment on top of all the kinds of technological devices that are in the road. So one experience I recently had was walking out of my house on garbage collection day, and the poor garbage truck was trapped by no less than 3 Waymos. It's like garbage truck, Waymo, Waymo, Waymo. And comically, another Waymo pulled in behind it. I don't know what that Waymo must have been smarter. It just had a look and was like, wah, wah, turned around. But this poor garbage truck was stuck there. And, you know, as a pedestrian and someone living in a city, I'm looking around and I see that my experience as someone walking through a city, it's determined by the shape of technologies, that by the shape of roads as technologies, and by the decisions of urban planners. And now there's this additional layer of kind of algorithms made flesh in a way as they move through the environment. And they all kind of contra my experience of moving through the world, right? And if I pull up my phone, which is something that I carry all the time, if I want to go somewhere, I could look on Google Maps. It might tell me to walk somewhere, and perhaps I'll be mindful and look around me as I walk. Sometimes I just follow the directions, and I don't really know what my experience is of moving through the world. I just get where I'm going, which I think is a symptom, right, of a lot of the remapping of our world through these kinds of digital maps. So there's all kinds of ways that this initial organic encounter of foot and world becomes mediated and transformed, first by more basic technologies, and now just layer after layer after layer of kind of digital intervention.
Vanessa, I was in San Francisco about a month ago, and Waymos were everywhere. And I really, really wanted to take one. I was fascinated by these. And I said to my wife, let's get in a Waymo. And she said, no, we have to get our steps in. So I'm sitting there thinking, wow, we've become kind of like obsessed with this. And there's this growing pressure to optimize ourselves. And to the point where people actually compare how many steps they got in that day. And last summer, I was just getting very frustrated with this. So I took my dog to the dog park. I put my Fitbit around his collar and I threw the ball for him for 20 minutes. And then I got back and told everybody I did 40,000 steps, beat that. But it's a story because we feel that there's this pressure in terms of, you know, trying to measure ourselves against other people. And I think that this kind of maybe affects mental health and stress or body image. I'm curious, are you seeing any of this?
Yeah, I mean, measuring ourselves against other people and against this somewhat arbitrary figure, right? I mean, I think most people think about 10,000 steps as the metric, but that's a really problematic figure. Yeah, people are certainly, I think, feeling that kind of pressure, and there is a competition. You know, I mean, part of the problem though is that we are at, you know, many of people who work on computers or who have sedentary lives have other metrics that they have to meet, you know, the number of emails, I suppose, that you have to respond to, or the you know, other kinds of performance metrics that you have to meet in your work and your life. So in a way, like steps becomes a way to return you to embodiment. And so for people who are really disconnected from their bodies, which is very common and a symptom of the world in which we live in, it can be useful. But people are not, I think, being in their bodies and understanding the kinds of pleasures and pains of understanding like how you feel on any one given day, or, you know, just taking a walk. Did you have a good day at the dog park that day? Was it?
A great day.
You
The
had a
dog
great
had a
day.
better day.
And you weren't thinking about it, right? You were just there, and you were exercising. Same then as when you're doing housework. That is moving. It does count, but maybe not everything needs to be counted.
And I don't think these tools are necessarily neutral either. And I'm wondering, you know, who has access to this data beyond us, right? Which brings us to the bigger question about authority and control. And you explore how people negotiate control with their devices. What strategies have you seen for using these technologies without letting them loose into the world?
So what do you mean without letting them loose into the world? Do you mean the devices?
The data.
Oh, the data, right. I mean, this is a devil's bargain. If you want to use them, you probably signed a 100-page terms and condition without thinking about it, which is going to change without, you know, without your permission. If you want to use a corporate device, then you are going to be using that, sharing that data, and then that data is going to be used in a way to probably sell you some stuff, right? A friend of mine asked me after she read my book what she should do as a woman of childbearing age who doesn't want to have children, but who is repeatedly sold and advertised the kinds of things that such a woman is supposed to want. And, you know, I said, well, you know, you could turn it off, I suppose. You could turn off, there's, you know, there's always settings you can turn off to have non-personalized advertising. But it should really be up to her. I think you can either, if you're wanting to use these things, then you're going to either have to choose open source or companies that often not American companies that are trying to do something different, or not use them. I think that's really the choice that you have to evade, or and also maybe in kind of in longer term thinking, and that's kind of part of the argument of my book, start to integrate people into the design process who have real skin in the game and who can kind of reflect more expansive choices for our embodied kind of future.
I love when we have on the show, and we do from time to time, people who do, that's what they do. It's, you know, what do they call it? Human-centered design or smart design or any of those things that it's comforting to know that the human element will continue to be an absolutely crucial part of our technology. You know, we're out of time, so we need to wrap, but I did want to make the comment that the delightful part about your book is, you know, reading about Eliza, that was, you know, before Siri, Alexa, ChatGPT, any of that, developed at MIT in 1966. And it was this whole thing. It wasn't called a chatbot, but it was called a chatty
Chatterbot.
chatterbot. Yes. And, you know, the tendency that we have as humans to, we're so concentrated in the present that we forget that there were these very real things in the past that were all a part of technology or whatever it is that affects our lives. And so I really appreciate that historical perspective that you throw into the book.
Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah, it's a really fun book. It's The Body Digital, A Brief History of Humans and Machines, from Cuckoo Clocks to ChatGPT. Vanessa Chang has been our guest. Vanessa, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me.